Golf Smarter, number 586, published on April 4, 2017, is brought to you by DraftKings.com. Now the stage is set for the first major of the year, and it all begins this Thursday in Augusta, Georgia. To celebrate, DraftKings.com is hosting a free fantasy golf contest with $100,000 in total prizes that could be yours. Golf is just too difficult of a sport to handicap over an entire season, which is why taking advantage of a one-week fantasy golf at DraftKings is perfect. Because fantasy golf on DraftKings.com is just so easy to play. All you have to do is pick six golfers before the tournament tees off this Thursday morning, April 6th. Then sit back and follow the action live. Rack up points for streaks, per hole performance, tournament finishes, and more. And when you outscore your competition, you win. You really can't get deeper into the major than this. Millions of fantasy sports fans have experienced the excitement of DraftKings, so why don't you? It's your turn. And if you're not sure which players to pick, then listen to last week's episode of Golf Smarter with the Tour Junkies live from Augusta, because they laid out the most interesting and compelling draft picks for this year's Masters. Remember, the Masters starts this Thursday morning, so hurry to DraftKings.com now. Get free entry in the $100,000 contest with the promo code GOLFSMARTER. That's one word, GOLFSMARTER. To play for free for your share of $100,000 in total prizes only at DraftKings.com. Eligibility restrictions may apply. See DraftKings.com for details. And stay tuned to the end of this episode for a very important announcement that will impact every Golf Smarter listener, whether you're a premium subscriber or not. This announcement will please you. Phil Mickelson's coach says if you practice what you're terrible at, you'll get a lot better quicker.
This is Golf Smarter, sharing stories, tips, and insights from great golf minds to help you lower your score and raise your golf IQ. Here's your host, Fred Green.
Dave Pels, welcome to the Golf Smarter podcast.
Well, glad to be here.
It's an honor to have you on the show. We usually have the unsung heroes of golf instruction on this program, and I've been doing it for a long time, but you're definitely one of the sung heroes of golf.
Well, I have been in the game a long time, and I do sing a lot.
Well, we'll get you to close out with a number, your favorite number. But, you know, when I was doing the research on you before I wanted to start this conversation, and it didn't just have to be about short game stuff, but I was just amazed to see that everything that I read either called you a scientist, a coach, an author, an entrepreneur, a businessman, a club designer. I mean, there were so many descriptions of who you are, what you do. So my first question would have to be, who are you?
Well, honestly, I believe the description on our website says I'm a scientist who loves the game, and that's very accurate. I love to do research. But I was doing research in space for Goddard Space Flight Center back in the day, in 1975, and I was loving it. I really did. But I had been playing golf since I was seven. I just love to play the game, and I thought, as much as I love my job at Goddard Space Flight Center doing space research, I really am a golfer who loves to do research rather than a researcher who loves to play golf. Golf really was first. I went to school on a golf scholarship with the intent to play the game professionally. I wanted to play the PGA Tour, and I was on scholarship, so I thought I could do it. I was on a four-year scholarship, and I happened to major in physics. Now, I love physics and I love numbers. But when I got out of school, it was clear to me after 4 years playing in the Big Ten and competing against a guy, fat little guy named Jack Nicklaus, I didn't do very well. And it was clear to me that I could not make the PGA Tour. So I got a real job. I didn't chase the mini tours or anything like that. I got a real job and happened to get it at Goddard Space Flight Center doing space research and loved it. But after 15 years, thought, if you really looked at me with all-seeing X-ray vision, I was a golfer who loved physics rather than a physicist who loved golf. So I took a year's leave of absence and got into the game of golf. I had several patents by then. I was thinking about it all the time, and I did realize that I always had loved the game. And I thought, why not take a year's leave of absence and see how I would enjoy being in the game day in and day out. And I lost everything I had, but I loved it. And I thought my conclusion obviously was, well, if you love it that much, what if you really made money doing it? And so I resigned in 1975, January 1, 1975, resigned from Goddard Space Flight Center, NASA, and started in my golf career. And I've been in it ever since. I just love it. And NASA is my home page on my computer, on the website, APOD. It's Astronomy Picture of the Day, and I communicate with my buddies back at Goddard, and still love space, but golf's number one, space is number two, and here we go. I still love it. I get up every day thinking about it, and I have truly, truly enjoyed it.
On that January 1st morning, after probably a couple weeks break for the holidays, when you walked into your superior to tell them that you were leaving to pursue a life in golf, were they surprised? Or did they know this was coming?
Yes. No, no. Oh, heavens, no. No, in fact, we were a group of 10 scientists, and it was the aeronomy division, A-E-R-O-N-O-M-Y. And the definition of aeronomy, nobody ever knows it. It's the it's studying the physics of the Earth's and our planetary atmospheres. And we were chartered with sending probes to Venus and Mars, the first probes, and they all burned up because in Venus we had no idea how hot it was. And but then we got much better at it. You know, NASA was very young then. They had just put up Sputnik, and I got in on the excitement of doing everything we could in space. There was plenty of money in NASA back in those days, and it was really an exciting time, and I loved it. And I just always thought about golf. I, looking back on it, I was always a golfer first. When I went to school and was studying, I was a golfer. I took leave at Indiana University. I had a four-year scholarship, and it was a spring sport. In the fall, I would take an extra heavy load. In the spring, I'd take a light load, and I would still miss. But I took a light load because we had a lot of away matches, and we drove. In those days, we had a big, long station wagon from Indiana, and six guys would go in two station wagons with all our golf equipment, and we'd go play matches around the Big Ten. And I missed all of my finals every year, every semester. So I would go back, play golf, play in the tournament, play in the NCAA, and then go back to school when all the kids were gone, and I'd take all my finals. And while that was, you know, a fun time in my life, I really did get tired of studying, and I wanted to play the game. And when I was a senior, I got out of school. I couldn't make the tour. I thought about what I was going to do, and I actually enrolled at the University of Maryland in College Park, Maryland, enrolled in my first semester of graduate school, and started attending classes and realized, my gosh, I don't want to do this. I don't want to study anymore. I want to work at this place that was very close to us, Goddard Space Flight Center. Mm. Now, I had never heard of that when I moved to College Park, Maryland. I moved there to enroll in the University of Maryland. But I went out there and interviewed and got a job, which was the most amazing thing in my career.
at that point.
Great job.
At that point.
Yeah. I mean, straight out of school, I didn't know anything about space or sports. I mean, I had studied physics in, I mean, my major. I have a degree, a BS in physics. But I didn't know the real art and science of research. And I say the word art in there. You have to do things the right way, one variable at a time, if you're going to do true research. So I took that school learning into a job where you really were doing pure scientific research that has never been done before. We would design an experiment to measure something, what gases are in the atmosphere, how much they expand, how often do they change, how many are there, you know, how many molecules, for example, in this square meter of space, or cubic meter of space, and what happens when the sun hits it. And studying these problems that no one had ever thought of or studied before was really, and I was with a group of really, really nice human beings. And when I started telling you this story, I said there were 10 of us, and our division chief was a golfer. He was a real, he loved to play golf. He was terrible, but he loved to play. And we would go places and give scientific papers and play a round of golf. And then in my later years, I became a, you know, I said I was a 15-year career. Looking back on it, it's not that long, but to me it felt like a long time.
Sure.
I became a senior scientist, and I got to work on international satellites with the Germans and the Italians. And we put two Italian satellites and two German satellites into Earth orbit, and we sent some probes to Venus and Mars. And that is exciting stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And so I was really, really, oops, got my dog going crazy here.
That's okay.
I was really enjoying it.
They're enjoyed on podcasts. Yeah, dogs on podcasts are always a good thing.
Oh, okay. Well, I was enjoying it, and I really made a discovery in one of my off-hour thought sessions that I finally realized why I was never the player I thought I would be. You know, I could play well enough to get a golf scholarship, and I could play in the National Amateur at Ridgewood, New Jersey, and I played in some really good tournaments, the North-South Amateur in Pinehurst, but I couldn't win them. I could maybe finish in the top 10 if I played well, but I just could not win tournaments. And I finally realized why, based on a couple of measurements I made on my putting stroke, and I fixed it. I thought about it, built a device that built and patented a device that would show me what was wrong with my putting stroke when I did and did not hit the sweet spot. And all of a sudden, I became a much better putter, and I became a really, really better player. Now, this is 12, 13 years after I had been working at Goddard Space Flight Center and hadn't played that much competitive golf. All of a sudden, I was much better than I had ever been.
Wow. That must have been frustrating.
Well, no, it was exciting, actually. It was a startling event, but all of a sudden I realized what I'd been doing wrong. And when you realize, look, I've taken 50, 100, I don't know how many lessons from PGA professionals, and I had tried my heart out, and I'd never gotten any better. Everybody told me I had to do this or that, or, you know, they all worked on my swing, and it wasn't my golf swing at all. It turned out to be my short game and putting stroke that was my problem. It was really my putting stroke. And then I started doing research in the game while I was at Goddard, and I'd stay up really, really late doing some testing and some research. And I got the patent on this device, and some businessmen in the area, all of a sudden, now Pels is, I was medalist in the Maryland State Amateur that next spring. And they said, what's happened to you? And I told them, and it was a cute little story. And they said, look, if you ever want to get into the golf business, we could sell it. We could take your patent and sell a million of these devices. Because it was a thing I stuck on my putter that made me learn to make a better putting stroke. It made me learn to hit the sweet spot of the putter every time. And nobody had ever told me I was missing the sweet spot. Nobody can see that. In fact, there's probably not anybody in golf that had ever used that as a lesson result, any pro, any teacher, because it can't be seen. No one before I developed this device had ever come to that conclusion about any golfer. So it was interesting. And I thought, well, you know, I love golf. Why not? I talked to my boss. I said, could I take a year's leave of absence and not lose my longevity, my retirement, and all those things? He said, sure, go try it. He said, you'll be a better businessman. And by that time, see, after 15 years in the government, I am now a senior scientist. I'm designing and building instruments that I send into space, and I'm spending millions of government dollars building these devices. And he wanted me to learn to be a better businessman. So I took a year's leave of absence.
Wow.
And these businessmen gave me $75,000 to kickstart my golf company and golf career. And
what year was that?
About 1978.
So $75,000 was a tremendous amount of money.
I'm sorry. 78 was another. 75 is when I retired.
Then 75,000 is even more money.
Yeah. Well, 75. I took a year's leave of absence with $75,000, and lost it all. In 10 and a half months, I lost it all.
Oh.
So now we're in November, and I had taken a year's leave of absence in January, and on January 1 of 76, I had to decide go back or resign.
Oh.
Because I didn't have any more leave of absence. I had no loss of retirement, no penalties. I could fully go back to Goddard, and I just had enjoyed. I talked to my wife and said, look, if I enjoyed losing money this much, what if I made money? Because I thought, you know, I'm an optimist.
Clearly.
Plain and simple. I'm an optimist. Yeah, I thought I could do it. And I, mid-November, kind of made that decision. And December, thought about it, gave myself a month, talked to my parents. They both said I was crazy, and they advised me not to do it. And, in fact, my dad got mad at me. He did not talk to me. He was so proud that I was a NASA research scientist. He did not tell his friends for 5 years that I had left NASA and was on my own in golf.
Wow. Did that have an impact your relationship with your dad?
Oh, no. No.
Good.
He was
good.
That didn't affect that at all. But, I mean, it's only because I laughed at it. I thought that was a silly thing to be ashamed of, that I had resigned my government position and
sure.
gone into golf, because I love golf. He was a golfer, for heaven's sakes. He taught me the game, and we still had a good time. So that was not a problem, but the problem was I didn't have any money. So I mortgaged my house and both cars, and this is where it gets into being, you guy probably really is crazy. I mortgaged my house and both cars and lost it all.
Oh.
In 76. And in 77, I took my government retirement out. I had, I'd been there for 15 years, and I had retirement that I could withdraw. And I took it, and I lost it. And in the fourth year that I was out on my own, by then I had done a lot of research, and I had begun to understand the game better, how important the short game was, and what I was measuring. See, I was maybe at the time almost unique in the game in that I was doing true research, and I was measuring things. I had laser. I knew how to use lasers. I knew how to use a computer. And back in those days, nobody else in golf did.
No.
Golf was very artsy, and no. I went to every company, every major company back then. Now, back then, the big companies were Wilson and McGregor and Spalding. And they all, I told them, look, I'm a scientist. I can measure anything in golf. What do you want to know? What do you want to pay and find out from research? Because I'm a research guy. And they said, well, and this is not a joke, by the way. They said, our marketing campaign for next year is blah, blah, blah. If you can run a test to prove that, and we'll pay you handsomely.
Well, they were going to make the claim without even knowing if it was true or not.
Well, they did make the claim. They were prepared to make it, and they made it, it turns out, because I said, look, if I haven't run the test, but I know enough as a scientist, as a NASA scientist for 15 years, if I run the test, it'll prove that your claims, your advertising claims, are false. But there's no penalty for false advertising in the game of golf. You know, there are five companies that right now are claiming the longest ball.
Sure.
There are 10 companies that claim the longest driver.
Driver.
And there are all kinds of misstatements in golf that nobody ever researches, nobody ever proves. When I got into the game, there was no research in the game of golf. Almost zero. And that's why today Spalding and Wilson and McGregor, actually Wilson's the only one survived. And it's a very small company now compared to TaylorMade and Callaway and Titleist. But everything has changed because back when I was getting turned down for research, nobody was doing any research. Nobody would spend any money. And I would not do, I'm an honest man, I would not do phony research just to make money and let them say things that were not true. So I was starving and losing money and still loving it. And six PGA Tour players said, Pels, if you stay in the game, the six of us will give you money and we will invest in your career if you'll help us be better players. Because I had found out things about the game, and I had gone out and measured on these players some of their weaknesses, and it started helping them. In the 4 years that I was losing money, that's what happened. And I was out of funds, and then things turned around. I got the fifth year that I was in the business, I broke even. Now, I didn't make any money, but I broke even in the fifth year, and about 15 years after that, I was pretty much bouncing above and below the line. I spent many years in the game without making any real money, and then I met this beautiful, incredibly brilliant woman who was a mathematics major, majoring in statistics, specializing in statistics. And she started analyzing my test data and my results, and we became very good friends. And we married, I don't know, 5 years after we met. And she came to me one day and said, Pels, you are crazy. Everybody's right. You're losing money. You are not an advertising guy, no matter how good of clubs you make. And I had invented and created Featherlite golf clubs, and you're probably not old enough to remember them, but they were really a hit. But my business acumen was so bad that we almost went under because well, do you have a minute? I'll tell you this one
story. Oh, please.
Okay. Okay. In 1980... In 1985, I developed Dave Pels Featherlite. And in that year, I was just profitable with my company by, I don't know, $20,000, $30,000 at the end of the year. Now, this is a company with maybe 15 people in it, and I was making golf clubs that I thought were really good. And on sales of, we were making full sets of clubs, driver through putter. And on sales of $760,000, we made about a $25,000 profit. And that was one of my profitable years. You know, the year before I'd lost $10,000 or something like that. But I was bouncing around with what I thought was a successful golf company at the time. Me, the terrible businessman. And then I developed Dave Pels Featherlite golf clubs. And what they were, got the idea, it's a lighter head on a more flexible shaft. And if you make the shaft enough flex, soft enough that it will still flex. When you start down, it will flex back, and then it will kick into impact. And that's what a shaft does. That's why people can hit the golf ball so far, is that if you swing it with the right tempo and the right rhythm and timing and everything, you can flex the shaft on the downswing. The head falls behind the shaft, and then it kicks back and actually passes the shaft. Well, if you do that with a lighter head and a more flexible shaft, you can swing faster. For any given swing, you can swing faster if you have a lighter club in your hand. And that was the principle that I developed in Featherlight. And I tested some tour players that I knew well by then, and they all hit the ball further. In fact, I tested 50 of them, and all 50 ordered my clubs. Of course, they wouldn't have been paid for them because I didn't have any money. But they liked the clubs. They hit them farther. And, I don't know, I can't remember how many, 12 or 14 actually played the clubs on tour at the start of the year. And I went to the PGA merchandise show in 86. And that's with a record of the previous year having made $760,000 in sales. And I got $31 million worth of orders.
Now you're a good businessman.
Now,
at that point, yeah.
Now I'm a big success. Okay, great. Everybody loves Dave Pell's Featherlight because you can hit the ball further. Mm-hmm. Everybody that tried it hit him further. Okay. Now, at the end of 86, I am destitute, because when you try to move a company from 760,000, which is three quarters of 1 million,
right,
to 31 million,
yeah,
in 4, 5, or 6 months, it's just awful. You can't do it. We tried to buy all the shafts that we could get that were flexible enough, and we bought everyone we could get. We bought them all the ones that were in the market. And in fact, they tried to give us a lot of shafts quickly, and they started breaking. And we tried to get all the heads we could, and we couldn't get it anywhere near enough to fill all the orders. And in the ancillary publicity, where everybody was going kind of crazy over Dave Pell's Featherlight clubs, the big companies already had shafts, and they already had heads, and a lot of them. And what they did is they ground metal off the bottom soles of the clubs so they would be lighter, and they just put them on the old shafts they had, the stiff shafts. And there was Lynx Light and Penny Light and McGregor Light and all kinds of light, because they were copying Pell's Light. And I trademarked the name Featherlight. And they had all these other light clubs that were light heads on stiff shafts. And now when golfers swung, the lighter heads would not flex the stiff shafts on the downswing, and they wouldn't kick, and they hit the ball shorter. If you put a light head on a stiff shaft, you hit it shorter. If you put a light head on a flexible shaft, you hit it further. But the big companies didn't understand that, and there were no flexible shafts available. So they went ahead, they capitalized, and they sold on the light craze, which then ended in disaster at the end of that year, because everybody was hitting the ball shorter. And nobody is going to pay money to buy new clubs that you hit shorter.
No.
Golfers just don't do it.
No.
So that ended in disaster. It almost ended my career. One of my better ideas just ended in disaster.
Oh.
And then, of course, in 87, 88, and 89, the word light was a bad name. The companies had ruined the name. Now, I stayed in the business, and I continued to promote Featherlight, but then I came up with a putter that you could aim better, and it really looked very, very odd. It later became known as the three-ball putter and the two-ball putter. People thought I was crazy when I put three balls on a putter, on the top of a putter, but I found out people aimed it better, because the fourth ball was the ball you were playing and putting with. And even if you put two balls on the putter, when you put it down behind the ball you're putting, the three balls formed a straight line, and people aimed it better. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen a two-ball putter.
I've used one. I'm a big mallet user, and I started with the two ball.
All right, let me tell you the story of that one.
Awesome.
I created the two ball and three ball putter and patented it, and it was completely patentable. And I took it out to the tour and I tested, and I think 12 people played it in January, February, and March. Bernard Langer, Curtis Strange, Dee Wybring. I could go back and get the list, but I can't remember. There were a bunch of players. We go into the Masters, and there are 12 players playing on tour. Nine of them are in the Masters. I mean, they're good players. And so on Wednesday of the Masters, there's a sign in the locker room. Pels putters are outlawed, cannot be used in the Masters this year. This was on Wednesday before the, you know, one day before the Masters tournament.
Oh, my gosh.
And I ran into the clubhouse and I said, why? And they said, well, we just found out the USGA had a vote and they're going to be declared illegal.
Why?
And I said, why? Why? What in the world? I've read the book, a thousand times. What's the matter? They're not playing in shape.
Huh? What does that mean?
They're not playing in shape.
P-L-A-N-E?
Well, that's what I ask.
P-L-A-I-N?
P-L-A-I-N. No, P-L-A-I-N.
Yeah, plain. Just, they weren't boring.
I looked in the dictionary, and a plain woman is an unadorned woman. That's what the definition in the dictionary is. So it's a plain, unadorned putter, I guess. But they didn't like it. The USGA guys did not like it. And they outlawed it. And I went in and talked to them, and they said, look, it's just not plain in shape. I said, well, tell me, what do I have to do to modify it to make it plain? They said, well, we can't tell you that. You have to do it yourself, and then we'll rule on it.
Oh.
You see, the truth is, it's easy to say no. They did not want innovation in the game. And if they say no, nothing happens. Nobody. I didn't have enough money to sue them. I went to there was actually an article in Golf Digest that was erroneous that said I sued them. I never sued the USGA. I was thinking about suing them. I went to an attorney, and he told me for $40,000 up front, he would sue them on contingency. But I didn't have $40,000. I hadn't made a dime in the game. In fact, I'd just come off the Featherlight debacle, and I had barely survived. So I just said, you know, if you're going to outlaw my putters for no reason, then I just I'm getting out of the game. I'm gonna quit designing clubs. I'll go make a living another way. And of course, in my despondent attitude, my wife said, look, why don't you teach the game? You've got more research on the game than anybody. You know more about the game than most. So I found out, well, there is a market. All the players that I was working with like 20 PGA pros by that time. And there was a market for a teacher who the players said knew what he was talking about. And my wife suggested that I start golf schools. And she started my schools. And I said, I don't have time to work with pros. And she said, well, I've got three guys that want to come. They say every man has his price. What's your price? And I don't know if you remember back in 70, well, it was, you know, 86 by then. But the price of a lesson was $50 for a lesson. And I said, tell them I'll take $1,000 and I'll give them a putting lesson. And I said, that'll scare them away. I don't have time. I've got to make a living here. I've got to somehow make some money.
Surprise.
And she came back and she said, yeah, I got three guys that said yes. I said, no. Tell them I got to work with the pros. I don't have time. Yeah, I misunderstood what you told me. I really would charge $1,500. And we kept playing this game. And my first school came about 3 weeks later. I had four people paying $3,000 each.
Oh!
And I gave a weekend school, 2 days on a weekend, for $12,000. I made $12,000 in a weekend, and they thanked me and left smiling.
Wow.
Because they learned how to improve their putting, and, you know, they happily paid for it. So that was the founding and the start of the Dave Pels Scoring Game Schools.
Wow.
My wife's, it was her idea, and she, on the phone, arranged the schedules of amateurs who would call in, and every time we got four, I would teach them for, it ended up, I then sat down and really designed the optimum school after I'd given one. And I decided, I read a book on learning theory, and I really studied what I was doing back then in trying to teach people something. And I learned that what I really want is a three-day school with four people per instructor. And I got hired an ex-PGA Tour player, Tom Jenkins, who had retired from the tour at that time. And I had helped him while he was on tour, and I knew him very well. He came, and he and I gave golf schools, and we'd teach eight people for 3 days, and we'd charge them $4,000 a piece, and we'd make $24,000 a weekend. And it was a pretty good deal.
Yeah, I'd say so.
I made some money. Everybody paid in advance, no bad debts, no business to worry about. My wife collected the money. If they didn't pay, they didn't come to school. Nobody ever not paid. We've never had, in the history of our schools, which we've had every week since then, I mean, we don't have every week, but we have many, many schools. We have six different locations now around the country that are permanent yearly Dave Pell Scoring Game Schools. We have one international school in Dublin, Ireland. We've made a lot of money teaching the short game and putting. And everybody has, you know, we have the, if you do the surveys, Golf Digest and Golf Magazine have both run surveys, which put us among the top schools in the world. And we don't spend any on advertising. It's word of mouth. We do have an ad in Golf Magazine because I write for them, and instead of taking cash, I take the ad.
Oh, good.
Because they'll give me better value. But if I had to pay for the ads, there would be no golf schools. I mean, back in 2009 to 11, if you remember, mm-hmm. the country went into an almost depression.
Mm-hmm.
Well, about 20 to 25, I don't know sure what the number is, of the golf schools in the country went under. Anybody that had to spend money to advertise went under. But the good teachers, like, well, I don't mean good. I don't mean to say other teachers aren't good. The names, the big name teachers, like Butch Harmon, Hank Haney, Dave Pels, people who have a name and don't have to advertise, they made it through.
Right.
But
so when you made that $12,000 for that weekend, the first school you did, were you able to call your ex-boss back and say, "Okay, now I'm a good businessman"? He wanted you to be a businessman after that first year, and you lost all that money. It's like, yeah, that's not what I had in mind for you.
Right. The truth is, I never called him. He's now passed away, but he was a great friend over the years. And he knew that I always was and still am a bad businessman. My wife is the businesswoman of the family. She's the CEO of our schools. She runs the company. And, well, she answered the phone when you called. And she's
she found
been taking
you.
Care of business the whole time.
Yeah.
I mean, she without her, I would still be fighting the man. See, businessmen told me you had to have something to sell. People I talk to, I ask businessmen, a lot of my students are good businessmen. I mean, some of the titans of golf of the industries are golfers, and they always told me when I talked to them that you had to have a product to sell. They quickly told me you can't do research for a living. Companies never want to spend enough on their research. The business of golf is a marketing driven business. You know, Spalding had great ads, and McGregor had great ads, and Wilson had great ads. The problem they had in business was that other people who were good marketers, like Ely Callaway, came up with better equipment because of research. And then with equal advertising, the best product wins. But the best product with no advertising cannot compete with the mediocre products that have great advertising. can't compete. If nobody knows about it, they will not come.
Right.
You know, the old adage, build it and they will come. That's not true unless they know about it.
That was only an adage in a movie.
Yeah.
About the ballparks.
And I saw the movie, and I, you know, I was inspired as usual.
Yeah.
But it doesn't work if they don't know about it. That's why my relationship with Golf Magazine has been a cornerstone of my career, because I have written with them. Well, I have been at Golf Magazine longer than any Golf Magazine employee has been there.
Wow.
Any current day employee. I go way back. I've been writing for them since 86. Now, that's a long time, and most people run out of material. Every month I write, by the way. So, see, I've done 250 articles. More than that. I mean, I don't even know how many there are anymore. I've done, I don't know, 25 covers. Once a year, I do a cover for Golf Magazine. Mm-hmm. But I always do it based on research in the short game and putting. And there are a million shots around the green. I can do buried lies. I can do sand, buried lies in the sand, good lies in the sand. How about lies in wet sand? How about fluffy dry sand? Okay. You can imagine a bunch of articles. Now, how many types of grasses are there? How many speeds of greens? How many positions on the green? You want to stop balls fast? You want to make balls not have backspin and roll a long way? I can think of a, I mean, I wrote an article last week for Golf Magazine again. I do it every month, and it's just a tremendous source of material to be thinking about the game of golf and how people can play it better. That's all I do. I think about how we can play this game better and enjoy it more. That's my whole focus in my working life. It's number one in my working life. Of course, my family is number one in my life. But in my working life, it's golf, sun up till sundown, and as long as I'm awake at night.
It I'm sounds like golf. That the key to your success was not a service or a product. It was your passion. I mean, it sounds everything that you've mentioned, you said, I loved what I did when I was doing it.
Yes. Even when I was losing everything I had.
Yeah.
I lost my government retirement. I lost my home. I lost both cars. And I sat there thinking, God, this is great. This is fun. I mean, can you imagine getting up in the morning and all you do, you think about how can I play this game better? How can I play it better? Now, the truth is, I don't really care about my game anymore. I want to help others because the world, I mean, I actually had this thought one time when I was thinking. I mean, it's not that I have, a thinking session from 2 to 5 every day. That's all I do when I get up in the morning. I'm sitting eating breakfast. I'm thinking about golf. I'm thinking of these things. And I thought, does the world need a better golfer? See, several times in my career, which is like right now, I know something that nobody else in the world knows. I've done that several times. I knew that if you took a light club head and swung it faster, you'd hit the ball further because speed is more important than mass. Now, I knew that because I studied physics, but the people that made golf clubs didn't even think about that. They got knotted heads on a branch of a tree and hit a ball, and it went pretty good, and they said, hey, here we go. It's a fun game. But there was no physics in the game.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, by the way, Featherlite was not a success commercially. It was a failure. But that was 86. In 2001, 15 years later, Callaway golf clubs had the same weight heads as Dave Phelps Featherlite. They had the same weight shafts and more flexible shafts, which hit the ball further. Now, the research was correct. The product was correct.
It was the supply chain. It was your supply chain that was off.
Right, right, right. We would have been hitting the ball further earlier if I had been able to deliver the product to the market, but I was not able. Emi Callaway comes along and says, you know, this is his research guys found out the old Featherlite concept was right, and they made lighter club heads with more flexible shafts, and they were made out of graphite. Now they have graphite shafts where they can put the weight where they want to, and they can put the kick where they want to, and they can make them more flexible without breaking. And they can even make the swing weights seem the same, so they don't seem like odd clubs. And everybody loves them. I mean, that's what, you know, then they got on the kick of more flexible faces. That was all based on research. See, all the modern companies, TaylorMade does a ton of research. Callaway does a ton of research. Titleist doesn't do as much in clubs because their balls carry them. But they do a ton of research on balls. And it's all based on research. I mean, better products with good marketing do succeed in the marketplace. I just never had any marketing or any inclination to even try to market. I mean, I never thought about it. I'm just not a marketing person.
Mm-hmm.
But by the way, that's the story of how I got from there to here. I'm sitting here talking to you, and I know how to read greens better than anybody in the world, better than anybody in the history of the game of golf. We have cracked the code on green reading, and we're starting a campaign next month to try to raise some money to write the books and create the videos and the programming that we need to get the concept to the world.
And this is a Kickstarter campaign you're going to be doing?
Right, right. On March 8th, we launch on Kickstarter Dave Pell's The Secrets to Green Reading. And we've got all the research. We've done everything. In fact, I've almost done with drafting the book. And now you want me to tell you one more little tiny story?
Yes, sir. I do.
By the way, these are dead true. I'm not exaggerating on any of my stories.
Oh, this isn't
these
fake news?
True.
This is not fake news?
You know, right. This is not fake news.
Well, actually, what you were telling me in the beginning about how the companies were telling you, we're going to make these advertising claims. Can you prove it? That, to me, was fake news, right? The USGA telling you that the putter isn't plain enough, that was fake news. You were way ahead of it.
Well, it's... somebody told me this, the guy who leads the pack is the one with the arrows in his back. If you're ahead of your time in any way, it's a tough go. But listen, I have no complaints. I mean, have you ever seen my backyard?
Yes.
I'm not a wealthy, wealthy, wealthy guy. I'm not among the Bill Gateses and the Donald Trumps. But I have made some money. I've got a backyard to die for. I've got the best backyard in the world.
In the world.
And this has been in the world. This is named by Wall Street Journal. The Wall Street Journal guy came here, writer, looked at my backyard and said, this is the best backyard in the world for a golfer.
Yeah. I mean, I live next to a golf course, so I've got two holes right behind my course. That's good. No, it's not even close to what you have.
No, you live on a golf course. I live on golf. See, I can walk out in my skivvies at 6 a.m. and I can hit shots that you wouldn't dream of. I can hit to the 17th green at the Players Club. I can hit to the 13th at Augusta.
Amazing.
I can hit to the 12th at Augusta. I have 8 greens, target greens in my backyard that are just the most beautiful greens I've ever walked on. The 14th at Pebble Beach. The 17th at Pebble. I just love that course. I love those greens. And I've built them in my backyard. So I've had, for what Dave Pells can conceive of in his lifetime, I've had a tremendous amount of success, and I have no complaints. The USGA drove me out of manufacturing and into a market, the teaching market, where my wife has succeeded financially. Now, I've been doing the same kind of work the whole time. I'm just sitting here thinking about golf. But my wife turned the USGA's refusal to let me manufacture the two-ball putter. She turned that into a teaching career that's been very successful.
Mm-hmm. And do you use your backyard as a teaching tool, or is it just for pure enjoyment for you?
No, it's for research.
Research.
You can say it's for enjoyment for me because I enjoy research.
Yeah.
But it's out of the backyard has come cracking the code of green reading. Out of the backyard has come ways to hit wedge shots that we teach in our schools that I did not know before I had a chance to just spend hours and hours. I waste no time driving to a golf course because I've got everything in my backyard.
Sure.
That you can do on a golf course. I've got a 400-yard range. See, I own 24 and a quarter acres.
Okay.
I've got a 400-yard range.
And where is this?
I can hit any shot.
Are you in?
In Austin, Texas.
You're in Austin, Texas. Okay.
Yeah. And I've got every shot inside of 125 yards to a target green that I can hit from uphill lies, downhill lies, ball above feet, ball below the feet, from the rough, the fairway, from tight lies, from plush lies. I got it all. Everything you want. Mm-hmm. And I do it every day. I'm doing stuff out in the yard, having fun, and learning, studying the game. I'm still doing research virtually every day. Mm. By the way, the two-ball putter was outlawed at the Masters. It remained illegal for 14 years until Ely Callaway had a director of research. His name was Richard Helmstetter, came to me and said, we would like to buy your patent. And I said, well, Dick, you're a friend of mine. I'd sell it to you happily because it's illegal. It's been illegal for 14 years, but I wouldn't do that to a good friend. And he said, well, I don't care about the legality. I think we've got a design of a putter that reads on your patent, and we'd like to buy it. And this is another detail that is true, but it's a little known detail in the game. He offered me $80,000, which I thought was a tremendous amount of money, being a guy who didn't have any money. I said, no, but I knew what, I mean, I had been in the industry a long time by then, and I knew that a putter, the way to do a putter deal is to license your patent for $2.50 a putter. And that $2.50, you know, putters were $60, $70, $80 a piece then. And, two and a half doesn't put it out of reach, doesn't make the putter so expensive it won't sell. And yet, if they sell a bunch, it can make some money. And if they don't sell many, it doesn't hurt them much. So it's good. It's a win-win. Okay, so he said, no, my people won't let me do that, pay a piece price, because we don't know how many we're going to sell. He said, he hung up the phone, called me back a week later and said, look, I talked to the board. They'll let me pay you $125,000. I talked to my wife, and she said, no, we don't want that. We want $2 a putter. Tell them the $2 a putter, that's our final offer. That's as low as we'll go. And Dick said, well, let me take it back to the board. He called back a week later and said, look, Pels, I want to pay you. My people will not let me pay you a dime a putter. It doesn't matter. They're not going to pay you per piece. What they want to do is pay you up front, own the patent, and then do anything we want to with the putter, and we'll pay you $250,000.
Wow.
Now, to a guy who's been starving for up to 20 years, that starts to be attractive.
Sure.
And we took $250,000, gave him the... Now, this is a 14-year-old patent. You know, patents only last 17 years.
Right.
And they had 2.5 years left when they bought it. Now, the funny thing about it is that Dick called me back the next week, and, of course, again, evidence that I'm a bad businessman. He said, Pelsey, we got the USGA approval. We threatened to sue the USGA, and they backed down, and so it's been approved, and we're going to take it to market. And I said, are you really? I mean, I didn't mind. I said, I couldn't have backed Callaway, the USGA down. And they went to market with it, and since they went to market with the two-ball putter, they have sold 5.5 million putters.
Oh my!
Now, if I had been the best businessman, you know, at $2.50 a putter,
or two,
5.5 million.
Yeah, right.
It's a pretty good. Yeah, even at $2, it's a good chunk of change.
Yes, it is.
11 million. But I got $250,000, and I have no complaints because, yes, they're better business people than I have ever been or ever will be, but I don't care about that. My days are not made of money. I don't get up thinking about making money. I get up thinking about how to play golf better, how to get the ball in the hole better, how to hit a better shot out of trouble. I mean, I've written a book on damage control, how to minimize the problems in your game when you hit shots into trouble, because most golfers, it turns out, this is just a fact, most golfers play 15 to 16 holes around, three shots lower than their handicap. their handicap is based on their disaster holes.
Yep.
You know, people shoot, a guy who plays, a mid-handicap guy, shoots 6, 6, 5, 5, 6, 6, 5, 4, 6, 9, 6, 6, 10, 6. Mm-hmm. And those 9s and 10s are what drive your handicap up.
Mm-hmm.
And they're caused by hitting into trouble. And then once you get in trouble, you have no idea how to get out, and you hit it into worse trouble. You hit it out of the frying pan into the fire.
Yep.
And you make big disaster numbers.
Yep.
And even pros, if you look at their scores, they play, they shoot 3-4-4, 3-3-4-4-6. And my best student ever is Phil Mickelson, and he shoots 3-3-4-4, 3-3-4-7, 3-3-3. I mean, he just makes sixes and sevens all the time. And it's hitting out of the frying pan into the fire. I wrote a book on damage control. Now, that's how much I think about the game. And I came upon this because I saw, we take data every year at the Myrtle Beach World Amateur. And in recording all the scorecards, one of the deals is I do a presentation. Do you know about the World Amateur?
Yes.
In Myrtle Beach?
Sure.
Okay, they have 4 days of tournaments. They play four rounds, and then they put everybody in handicaps, so like 3,000 or 4,000 golfers into 100 player groups of identical handicaps. Everybody has the same handicap within a shot, and they play four rounds. Well, my deal is if I go give a presentation at night at the Myrtle Beach Convention Center where all 4,000 people come, they will let me bring my research staff to the tournament all 4 days and take data.
Wow.
On any shot I want to take. And I set up, I had a contract with the PGA Tour. We used ShotLink, all of their equipment, and we measured where every golfer of every handicap hit every shot. And I'm analyzing the difference on a wedge shot from 30 yards. What is the 30 handicapper? How does he hit it? How close does he hit it? How about a 20? How about a 10? How about a scratch? And that's what we do every year. Well, part of this deal is I get all their scorecards. And when I put all these scorecards into a computer, computers are fantastic. I just started looking and seeing that every golfer shot below his handicap for most holes of every round, and then they'd have a few disaster holes. And then I got the golfers' names, of course, which are on their scorecards, and I interviewed the golfers, and I found out, well, that was a disaster hole. I mean, it ruined my round. I just couldn't, I got in trouble, I couldn't get out, and I'm playing a tournament, I go from the frying pan into the fire, and I made an 11. So I wrote a book about it.
Yeah, you know, one of the mantras that we have for the Golf Smarter podcast that I've been now doing for a long time, and I learned this from one of the listeners, was never follow a bad shot with a stupid shot.
That's great advice. That's called damage control.
Right, right. I mean, I was watching one of your videos the other day, and you said, only try this when you've practiced it a lot. And that's what
right.
I see all the time. And, you know, I don't play with single digit players. I'm a 12, and I play with my friends. We're all around the same, but I'm not playing with scratch golfers or, you know, good golfers, low handicap golfers. And I see it a lot where people think, well, I'm only 160 out behind 18 trees and, a lake and a pond, and
right.
I can reach the green from here. No, you can't. Don't do that.
Well, you know where players hit the ball off the banks of creeks? They hit them into the creeks.
Right.
They don't get out very well. And that's damage control. I wrote a whole book on it, and it was a fun book to write. It's really true. I have actually went out in preparation for this book and caddied for some guys and guided them in how to hit this shot back into the fairway. Because if you hit the shot back into the fairway closer than you would normally have been on the first shot, let's say your first shot is bad and it goes into the bank of a creek. If you hit it out of this bank to a place where it's closer to the green than your first shot, then it should cost you less than a whole stroke.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're further than you would have been if you'd had a perfect drive. And in fact, it averages out to be about 7/10 of a shot. If you really look at a good pro when he hits a shot into trouble, it only costs him about 7/10 of a shot. Doesn't cost him a whole shot. But an amateur, when he hits it into trouble, it could cost him 5 shots because he hits it out of trouble into worse trouble and then out of there into worse trouble yet.
Right. It gets so frustrating. You know, I've done nearly 600 episodes of this podcast in 12 years. And in that time, like I was telling you before, the unsung heroes of golf instructors, I talked to all kinds of instructors really focused on game improvement. How does the amateur weekend golfer like myself get better, you know, by improving their headspace and their shot selection, things like that. But I've also talked about aim point putting, instinct putting, banana putting, extraordinary putting, zen putting, and the list goes on. And every swing mechanics teacher I interview says, I've discovered the secret to Ben Hogan's swing. I mean, there's so many different messages out there that can make it so confusing for all of us, especially the mid to high handicap golfers.
Right.
And so Yoda, what advice?
Well, how many guys have told you how to read greens based on physics?
I think aim point may have been the closest thing to it, and I don't even know if that considered physics. I mean, you were doing advanced metrics before they even knew what advanced metrics was, and now it's permeated every sport that they take the research and the numbers and grind them out and say, you know, you would really improve if you just did this. You are way ahead of the curve.
That's right. You know, the PGA Tour created ShotLink after we worked with them for several years, and they found out what I was doing on my own, walking the courses, charting the games of the players that I worked with, and those players were improving. The Tom Kites and Andy Norris, they started winning U.S. Opens and started winning major tournaments because I could measure where they were weak, and we could fix their weaknesses. You don't get better by improving your strengths. You get better by improving your weaknesses. That's what kills you in golf.
Absolutely agree.
Your good shots, you can spend, you know, it's the law of diminishing returns. If you really think about it, if you practice what you're already good at, you can practice a long time and only get a little bit better. If you practice what you're terrible at, you can get a lot better quickly. And that's my mantra that I teach. I say, take your weakness and make it a strength, and you've made a major change in your game. Now, that's hard to do, but especially it's hard to do if it's a full swing thing, because, I mean, you and I can practice all day, every day for the rest of our lives, and we'll never drive it like Dustin Johnson. We don't have the bodies. We don't have the strength. We don't have the athletic ability. We just can't drive it 330 yards straight down the middle. But you and I can chip it in when he's chunking it. Hunter Mahan's one of the best ball strikers ever, and he just had really – he was a poor chipper, and he kept hitting them fat. And it just has ruined his game so far. I hope he makes it back, but he's struggling. He's been struggling for years.
Tell me one more time about this Kickstarter campaign, because I want to make sure. Kickstarter. I want everyone to know what it is and where to go find it and when it's going to be available. Do you have that information?
All right. May 8th. That's a month from now, about.
Of 2017.
And it's only available at PelsGolf.com/greenreading. Now, that's a URL that you log on to, and it'll take you directly to Kickstarter.
Okay.
And Kickstarter is a company that is helping us promote this campaign. To what I want to do with the money is write the book, pay the programmers to do the graphics, three-dimensional graphics that allow you to see what you're doing wrong, why what you're trying now will never work, and to shoot the videos that will be required to show you how to do the new green reading technique. It's simple. It takes about the same time as the normal golfer on a green, but it's more accurate, and it's based on physics and the green conditions rather than some theory that somebody thought up. You know, people use plumb bobs They squat down. They look low to the ground. They try to sense the side slope that their ball is sitting on with their feet, or they put their fingers out in front of their heads and try to guesstimate the break. What we're doing is saying, if you do this, 1, 2, 3, 4, and I'm not allowed to tell you what it is because Kickstarter people are going to be the first people that know. They're going to get the first books and the first videos and the first on-course guides. That's what we're doing, is making a package. It's a book and a vid and many videos and an on-course guide that will show you. And you read this book, and I promise you, you'll read greens better and make more putts. That's the whole project in a nutshell. It's encompassing about 10 years of our research. It's taken us a long time to crack the code, but we finally understood why the old system didn't work. The old system of looking at the side slope your ball is sitting on. Listen, do this for me. Imagine you're behind your ball and you're looking past the ball towards the hole. Okay, that's the ball hole line.
Mm-hmm.
All right, you got it?
Mm-hmm.
Now just imagine that you're on a tremendously sloping green. If the right side of the green is higher, the left side is lower. So you're looking at a right to left side slope.
Okay.
You got it?
Yep.
Now you're going to read how much putt's going to break. And let's say you think it's going to break 2 feet. Big break.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're looking from the ball to the hole. You've read that side slope. Realize your ball is never going to touch that line. You're not going to putt on that slope. If you do, you're going to miss it below the hole.
Correct.
That's why the present green reading system doesn't work. Because you never putt on the line you're looking on. That's the wrong place to look.
I've always...
And you can't...
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
You can't, in fact, even... You couldn't even say, okay, oh, I'm going to aim 2 feet to the right. Now look at the side slope up there. But where? It changes. The slope changes. Every foot the ball moves, the slope changes. So what you're doing, the way you're reading greens is wrong. Plumb bobs don't work. The spider technique, you know, Camilo Villegas gets down on the green, gets his eyes right on the green, looking at this side slope. But the whole point is that doesn't do him any good because that's not where the ball rolls. That's not what determines how much break there is.
Mm-hmm.
So we've figured it out. We've got a computer model that we know. We can tell you how much every putt breaks.
Hmm. I want to know.
Anyway, that's it's the... Well, listen, you got to go to Kickstarter.
So that starts at May 8th, 2017, and runs how long? Do you have a sense?
60 days, two months, that's all.
Oh.
And if we don't get funded, then there's no risk. Because if you order our book and videos, you'll get them in by Christmas. We've done enough work that we're confident that we can get them out by this Christmas. If not enough people do this, then you all get your money back. You can't lose. You either get the book and the videos or you get your money back. You can't, we're not going to collect money and then not deliver the product. We don't get the money if not enough people contribute to actually afford to pay for the product. So I've written 8 books already, or 7 books. I'm sorry, this is my 8th. Mm-hmm. But I've written 7 books, and so I know how to write books, and we will write it and finish it if we get funded. But the problem is programming is so expensive.
Sure.
Three-dimensional programming, I don't know if you've ever known about doing any three-dimensional program, but it's very expensive. And hiring a video crew to shoot really good videos to show this is a very visual thing, reading greens, and... So that's why, even though I'm heavily invested in this, I've been doing research for 10 years on it, I don't know how many books to print. I don't know how much video to shoot, because I don't know if there are very many golfers that are really aware that they don't read greens very well. So that's why we've gone to Kickstarter. They will help us gauge how much interest there is in this product. See, I'm sitting here thinking every golfer, if they read greens better, they're going to make more putts. And I don't know anybody that reads greens very well. Even the pros that I work with, don't read greens very well. I mean, I can go out and prove to them that I can read better than they can. And they say, wait a minute here. Did you know that Phil Mickelson is now in the top 10 in putting for the first time in his career? Because he's one of only two guys I've told about it so far.
That's an amazing statistic.
It is. It is. It really is amazing. This is, in my mind, I've written 7 books. The 8th one, The Secrets of Green Beating, this is going to be my best contribution to the game. This is more important to the game than Featherlight. It's more important to the game than Damage Control or the Short Game Bible or the Putting Bible or anything that I've written. I think this is truly going to be beneficial to all golfers. Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
How many times do you putt around?
Me?
You're a 12 handicap.
Yeah, I'm between 35 and 38.
Okay. You have to read the green 35 to 38 times around.
Mm-hmm.
Every golfer, I don't care who you are, you have to read the green at least 30 times around.
Right.
To know where to aim your putter. I mean, even when you're 2 feet from the hole, if you're on a side slope,
yeah,
you know, you play a little break. And most, all of your first putts, you have to read. So there, you don't do anything else in the game this often. You don't drive it 30 times around. You don't hit wedges 30 times around. You only putt after you've read the green 30 to 40 times around. We all do it. We all need it. That's why I think everybody should invest in this book. What I'm asking you to do on Kickstarter is pre-order the book. That's all. You place an order, send it's $79 for everything, the book, the videos, the on-course guide, and you'll get the book in December. You'll get the whole package in December. That's what we're asking golfers to do. And we're hoping that enough to, we need at least 210,000, 212. That's what we've got a budget that it's going to cost us 212,000 to do this for a minimum number of golfers. Now, I hope more golfers will order, but who knows? But if we don't get 212,000, then they send every penny back. We don't get a dime, and that's fine with us. We're not trying to con anybody here. We're just trying to get the concept packaged and out to golfers so they can putt better.
And I just want to remind everybody in the Golf Smarter community that when you do sign up for this Kickstarter campaign, make sure that you tell them that you heard about it on Golf Smarter. I just wanted to let them know, you guys know that we've got an active community that's supporting what you're doing.
Perfect.
Let's wrap this up. This has been a remarkable amount of time to share with you, and I really appreciate it. I loved hearing your history and how you got to this point. Thank you very much, and I wish you all luck. Now, this coming weekend, the Masters, you want to make any predictions?
Don't bet against Phil.
That's exactly what I was hoping you'd say.
No, I really enjoyed the interview. I've been working hard this morning talking to you. I'm thinking about golf. I'm talking golf. That's what I do. It's a labor of love for me, and I wish everybody could enjoy the game as much as I do.
And I think that listening to what you just said will enhance our appreciation of the game. Dave, thank you so much for this time. And I will be back in touch with you that once the Kickstarter campaign gets going, we'll bring it back to talk more about it if you'd like.
Perfect. I look forward to talking to you.
Thank you so much, Dave. Be well.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Okay, I love doing this show because of moments like that. And I'm really happy that I'm doing this show and making this announcement. As of this episode, Golf Smarter Premium Access has been discontinued. To all of you who have stepped up and were paid subscriber of Golf Smarter, whether it was our original effort with members only or joining Premium Access, I can't thank you enough for the support. What it means is that every episode of the Golf Smarter podcast archives dating back to 2005 are available to everyone. If you'd like to see what there is for you to hear, go to golfsmarter.com and click on Archives for the entire list of episodes, including the episode number and the date it was published. Also, please note that the free Golf Smarter app is still available for iOS and Android, and each week it will automatically download the newest episode in the background for you to hear whenever you're ready. If you have any questions or comments, please write to Fred at golfsmarterpodcast.com or click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.